This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. This past July, we spoke with several leaders in our region who organized protests calling for racial justice. And today, we're checking back in with those leaders to find out where the movement is today and where it could go in 2021. With me now on the phone is the Reverend Dr. Anthony Bennett. He's the lead pastor of the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he's the co-chair of CONNECT, that's a collective of churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and civic organizations from New Haven and Fairfield counties. Pastor Bennett, welcome back to The Full Story.
Glad to be with you today.
Pastor, could you first remind us about CONNECT and the work that you do?
CONNECT is a collective of more than 35 institutions, religious institutions, across race, across geography and economic status to engage with their collective or their mutual interests and mutual respect to engage in public life for the sake of building relational power to achieve what we believe we need to achieve.
We spoke back in July, as I mentioned before, when protests were happening around the country in the wake of several killings of black people by police. How did the protests and the movement progress from that point on for the rest of the year? What kind of intensity was there?
I believe follow through, of course, on, I guess, a statewide level was the police accountability bill, though controversial, on both ends of the spectrum, shared or attempted to move toward a greater level of accountability for law enforcement officers who engage in excessive force that ultimately leads to deaths and unnecessary deaths and murders of the citizens.
Has CONNECT had the opportunity to work directly with the police since the introduction of the police accountability bill last year?
I think CONNECT focuses on sort of its campaigns. One particular campaign is Clean Slate that looks to push for criminal justice reform. And I think that's the efforts, those are the efforts that CONNECT has done. Certainly other organizations and other Black Lives Matter organizations, local, they continue to push for police accountability to this day.
The police accountability bill, the movement in that direction, is that an adequate response at this point from Connecticut's political leadership?
I think it's an aspect. I don't know if it's, there's always movement in direction. I think ultimately we just want police to stop killing innocent persons and unarmed persons. I think the events on January the 6th of this year underscore the fact that the reality is police already know how to engage in de-escalation. They just don't do it for black and brown communities. It's clear that law enforcement officers were able to restrain themselves during the insurrection that took place on January 6th. They did it with a predominantly white insurrection mob, and it's clear. And what we ultimately want for them to use that same restraint on black and brown protesters who don't come armed, who don't come in the ways that we saw. So it's clear. It's a matter of will. It's a matter of perception. It just continues the legacy of anti-black white supremacy that manifests itself most prominently in law enforcement engagement with people and with people of color.
Did what happened on the 6th at the Capitol in Washington, did that reverberate adequately back to Connecticut? In other words, have you heard from political leadership in the state? Has it modified at all the way that they're approaching police accountability and other issues connected with what the Black Lives Matter movement would like to see accomplished?
Well, I think the fight continues, the struggle continues. The interesting observation that I've made is the silence from police unions and the silence. Police officers were killed. So I don't see the volume of outrage, the level and the intensity of outrage that came from police unions and other places as we sought to just make the point, stop killing innocent people, stop killing people who may have done something but still have their day in court. And so I would just observe and wonder, both in Connecticut and really throughout the country, why aren't more police unions and other law enforcement organizations, those who tout Blue Lives Matter, why have they not, with the same zeal and vigor that they literally threatened, whether it was the protesters in Hartford, whether it was Representative Duff in Norwalk, there were jeers against that. But there seems to be a less intense and almost a muted reaction from law enforcement in Connecticut and throughout this country regarding which again speaks volumes about the complicity and the overall attitude that black and brown lives must be forced to engage in law and order, but white lives are given space to engage in what they believe is their First Amendment right.
I'm speaking with Reverend Dr. Anthony Bennett, the lead pastor of the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and the co-chair of Connect. Pastor Bennett, it's a new year. We do have new political leadership on the national level. What do you think about that in terms of moving forward, your plans for 2021? Has that changed the way you think about approaching these issues in this new year?
I'm very proud of my Morehouse and fraternity brother, the Reverend Dr. Senator Raphael Warnock. I am elated by Senator Oskoff at the possibilities of what can be in terms of their leadership, their support of those senators who are already there that are moving social justice items forward. But the truth of the matter is we are also in a very divided government and a divided country. So I am soberly hopeful that progress and movement forward can take place such that we are in a more inclusive way and not in a recessive way that we have seen in recent days and in particular on January the 6th.
In that same vein, how do you view the election of Kamala Harris to the vice presidency? Is that a sign that the country can evolve and maybe elevate itself from racial divisions? It does seem that those sentiments were talked about when Barack Obama was elected to the White House.
Well, you see what happened after President Obama left office.
Yeah.
It was the election of the former occupant in the White House. I don't think as much as I celebrate individual accomplishment and celebrate Vice President Kamala Harris, also an HBCU graduate, also a part of our sister sorority, I'm sure is fooled or naive to the deep divide in this country around race, around gender. And so you keep moving forward. I think it's primarily white Americans that sort of sense, now that she's elected, just like with Obama, we've moved beyond race without realizing this very country was founded on the sin of racism and the sin of anti-black and indigenous people. And until it reconciles that, and I think it's difficult, January the 6th speaks to that reality, that it is difficult to own that this country was founded on anti-black, anti-indigenous, white supremacy.
There are some in our country today, especially today, who feel emboldened now enough to act on their anger and their hate. How does a group like Connect, how do you confront this thinking? How do you change it?
I don't know if you change it as much as you make sure you don't have it. And if you have it in your mind, in your spirit, in your attitude, then you examine it and try to root it out so that you can become an anti-racist fighter and an anti-racist organization that speaks and continues to press forward for the social justice issues that we believe we have a right to fight for, which is the push for inclusion and not the push that we see and that we saw in the Capitol on January the 6th, which was a push for exclusion. And Connect and other organizations seek to push for inclusion in this democratic experiment.
Pastor Bennett, thank you so much again for your time today. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
The Reverend Dr. Anthony Bennett is lead pastor of the Mount Airy Baptist Church in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and the co-chair of Connect. Joining us now is a person who's been at the forefront of protest for racial justice in New York State. Shavonna Renee Newsom is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Greater New York. Ms. Newsom, welcome back to The Full Story.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Pretty well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Before we get started, please remind us about the background of the Black Lives Matter movement of Greater New York specifically, and the work that you do.
Black Lives Matter Greater New York was founded about 5 years ago. Me and my blood brother, Hawk Newsom, we founded the org together. And it comes a few years after BLM Global, and there was also an official New York chapter. But they were taking more philosophical approach and more approach of the arts for Black liberation. And with Black men and women dying in the streets or living in poverty or lack of education, the world, the city, it needed a radical and revolutionary response, and we were just filling a void. Since then, we have fed thousands of people. Specifically during the last year of COVID, we've fed about 7,000 people. We've opened up a school this year, a Montessori school, one of the only ones in the Bronx, New York, which is one of the nation's poorest congressional districts. And you know that falls in line with poor and inadequate education. So what we are fighting for is the full liberation of Black people. That means running candidates for office. That means proposing legislation. So we take a full holistic approach to the liberation of Black people in our organization.
When we last spoke, there was growing global momentum for racial justice. Did the protests last year, did they progress the way that you and other Black Lives Matter organizers had hoped?
Yes, actually, they were highly effective. And that's why the Nobel Peace Prize for the movement, that award is for the people who had never protested, for the new activists, for every single American or person around the world who came out after they saw the murder of George Floyd. Now, just to give people some context in what we gained from this movement and from the political unrest and the mobilization of people in the streets is, here in New York State, we've passed about 5 laws working with New York State legislator and Governor Andrew Cuomo directly. And that was just to quiet protesters is when the politicians who are supposed to work for us give us actual policy changes. Being that I've been in the game for some time, I knew that eventually it would die down. The momentum would stop. People would stop going to protest. New things would gain their interest, unfortunately. So it was so important for us to push very hard for the legislative changes that we wanted during that time.
So you felt like you had the political capital, so to speak, based on the momentum of the time to get some changes in public policy. So you did see somewhat of a shift in that direction. Back in June, you did say you believe the street demonstrations would give way to changes in public policy.
They absolutely did. As we see, I was on the ground in Minnesota about 2 days after George Floyd was murdered. I was actually on the spot where he lost his life when they arrested Chauvin, the officer seen on the video with his knee on his neck. So we've seen policy changes come out of Minneapolis. We've seen them come out of L.A. in New York, the Attorney General, New York State Attorney General Letitia James is now filing a lawsuit against police departments. We've repealed 50A, which is a bill that would protect the employment records of police officers. So even when there was trials, this information would be hidden. The use of special prosecutors are coming in, the chokehold ban. So, of course, and this is what we hope to do with the Biden administration, because let's be real, the Democratic Party capitalized heavily on the Black Lives Matter movement and the unrest in the street, and that was one of their major talking points. So I'm looking for an executive order to come outside of this administration.
Do you think that the racial justice policies that President Biden and Vice President Harris are promoting will indeed connect with your work, with the work that Black Lives Matter is doing on the ground in New York and I guess around the country?
I truly hope so. To do the work that I do and to be a servant, because that's what I am, I serve my community, I have to be optimistic. I truly hope so. I see a lot of executive orders coming out, and I hope that they repay their constituents, because if we look, especially speaking as a Black woman, 91% of Black women voted for this administration. We now have a Black woman who has broken that glass ceiling. So I hope that they look out for the interests of not only all Americans, but specifically to their constituency and to the people who put them into office. I don't know, because we know that the Democratic Party has a long history of capitalizing off of this momentum, off of times of crisis for people of color. People of color vote primarily Democratic, and we still haven't quite received anything. A few small legislative changes, a few tokenizations, but nothing really and truly concrete. I will love to hear more than a council come out about reparations. That would be a good start there, because if we look through history, any other people who have faced anything remotely compared to foundational Black Americans in this country, they have been compensated. Even slave owners were compensated when slavery was abolished.
Last year, you also said there were white supremacist groups that showed up at some of your events to counter protest. And of course, we all saw what happened at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Will progress in racial justice also mean a stronger backlash from these groups and from individuals, too, in New York and around the country?
I believe we spoke in June, and about roughly in July, my brother, who my fellow co-founder, gave a speech on a pretty popular he did an interview on a pretty popular Fox News network station interview, whatever, and Donald Trump had tweeted him directly and called him treasonous and seditious. And our organization is constantly under the supervision of law enforcement. And not only that, when former President Trump released that tweet, we've received thousands of death threats. So now not only do we have to fear law enforcement who hates us, he's kind of painted us a huge target for white militias. So we don't know. We look at the information that I'm sure everyone's seeing coming out of government agencies, and we know that the biggest threat to our democracy is white supremacy. So for the last 7 or 8 months, we've been on pretty much high alert here at Black Lives Matter Creed in New York.
So in a way, it's the downside of progress in racial justice. It's going to bring more people out of the woodwork who just don't want to see that happen.
Absolutely not. And we have to look at the history of America. We have to look at racism in America. Even the foundation of the police force with the Fugitive Slave Act and the deputizing of white men to be bail bondsmen, to collect Black people as property. And what was the real cause? What was the real issue? I know when we go out and protest, people were fighting a good fight. We have a list of demands. It's in direct response to some injustice that has happened. But why were the people really the domestic terrorists? Let's be real, because it really bothered me when they were called protesters and rioters. When the domestic terrorists invaded the Capitol, they had no real reason aside for hatred. Donald Trump had that was his campaign theme, anti-blackness. So, of course, if you profited and you've had an amazing life and been allowed to not live in poverty, to get home loans, to have access to jobs and education, unfortunately, they see when social justice situations happening and a racial reckoning's coming and black people are moving and up and elevating. Would you want to see that if you've always prospered off of black people being oppressed? So, of course, their response is always going to be violence because that's the American way.
You mentioned before that you have seen some shifts in terms of public policy in the wake of the protests last year. How do you see the Black Lives Matter movement evolving this year? Is there enough, again, so-called political capital left to continue the momentum on the public policy side?
I can only speak for Black Lives Matter, Greater New York, and how we see the shift. I think that BLM as a movement, it's kind of hit an apex, unfortunately, unless there's a huge string of murders of unarmed black people. So what we're doing is we've created black opportunities, meaning we are working on feeding our people, educating our people, teaching our people self-defense to police and practice public safety in their own community. And what we've had for quite some time is Black Lives Caucus, which is our political arm. We were the first people to endorse Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, although we've not seen any policy regarding black people coming by way of her office. We are continuing to do that. Right now in New York, there's maybe 40 seats open for New York City Council. So we need at least 7 of those seats. So we are endorsing candidates. So we've always worked on the public policy side as much as we believe in community aid and going out and feeding the hungry. Our efforts are not going to change because we have the same goal in fighting for black liberation and black equity in America. But our avenues of doing so, we know are going to change. As you've seen the momentum die down, what we always have to do as leaders and people who have been in this movement for a very long time, we have to see the next steps needing to be taken, and that's what we're currently working on.
Ms. Newsom, thank you once again so much for your time today. We appreciate your insights.
Always a pleasure, and have a wonderful Black History Month.
Thank you, and you too. Siobhana Renee Newsom is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Greater New York. Michael Oratade is the president of Black Lives Matter 860. It's a Hartford-based Black Lives Matter group. Mr. Oratade, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Were you at all surprised by the momentum that the Black Lives Matter movement was able to achieve last year?
To be honest, not really. I feel as though like a lot of things came together in order for the Black Lives Matter movement to surge the way that it did. The advent of the pandemic and the murder of George Floyd, I think it was time, you know, for that awakening. A lot of people were fed up with the previous president, and you know, everything kind of came together. And it was necessary, you know.
Did the protests and the demonstrations in Connecticut last year, did they have the impact that you hoped for?
Well, we got to understand this, that the journey towards anti-racism is a lifetime journey. The results have all been what we see in the activist community as first steps. So a lot of the steps that everyone is making towards equity, they're all very initial steps. But we are seeing a lot more momentum where there was none prior to the Black Lives Matter movement, and specifically prior to last year. You know, we have Biden, who completely jumped on the progressive, not completely, but he jumped on the goals that were set by progressives. And he jumped on board because he saw just how broad the progressive mindset was. You know, it's not enough to be a moderate anymore. He saw that, and he realized it. And his Biden plan really reflects things like the Green New Deal, his approach to private prisons. His pretty much his entire campaign was distancing itself from big corporations and things that don't really coincide with the progressive perspective, even though he is a moderate. So I think that, like, even though that is separate from Black Lives Matter, things intersect, right? That's intersectionality. And I think that that's being reflected not only through his administration, but as through our schools, through our towns. So I think that we're getting a lot of necessary first steps.
Last year, there was a lot of discussion about whether this was the real turning point. There had been, certainly in the past, going back many, many years, decades, even century or two, episodes that appeared to suggest the country was coming to terms with its own history, with the racial inequity history, with enslavement. And then things sort of returned to quote-unquote normal. But this past year, there seemed to be more focus on this being the real turning point. And you're mentioning also now there's the Biden administration in the White House. And I'll ask you that question. Is this the turning point? Is this really turning that corner toward the reckoning that the country needs?
The way that I see it, I see the country is, yes, I would say that this is the very first step towards that turning point. He's making a lot of decisions that reflect what we want for true equity, but we got to understand that Biden is not the answer, and that this is something that has been going on, like you were saying, for longer than most of us have even been alive. The civil rights era was 50 some odd years ago, and you know what happened is they found covert ways to continue to implement racist practices throughout a plethora of systems. They found a way to continue segregation, to continue slavery throughout the institutions, through our prison system, through the redlining of our neighborhoods, through the misdistribution of wealth in this country. So I feel as though this is a starting point. Biden is only going to be a starting point. He's doing some abolitionist work right now, which is impressive, but it's not going to be the end. And I think it would be kind of foolish to think that this is where it's going to end, that we are going to have to continue to fight. That is the answer. We have to continue to fight, or else someone will always sneak in and sabotage. It's like it's been that way throughout history. And I think we just need to understand that there was never a normal. There was never a time where America was great. It's always been a work in progress. And that's what people need to understand. And that's a big thing for me, progress. You know, America is going to always need work. It is never going to be the perfect place, but it can be. It's all the bones, it's all the structure to be the greatest place on earth. It really could be. And I think the rest of the world knows that. They look up to us. We are like a beacon. But with this entire thing that has happened, the insurrection at the Capitol, it was a complete embarrassment. And throughout history, America has had embarrassing moments that the rest of the world had to watch. They looked at us as the land of freedom, and then there's moments where we don't look so free. And that's when America tends to do its work. It tends to wake up and say, look, we need to do something about this. Our people are suffering.
You mentioned the covert actions that occurred after, have always occurred, but after the civil rights movement, primarily in the 60s. Very overt was the attack that you just mentioned, the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. Could you reflect a little bit more on that in the bigger picture of the move toward racial justice? How did you view that?
To me, we knew this. So those of us that are in the activist community knew for a fact that a coup was going to occur. There was no doubt in our mind that it was going to occur. All it was when. We knew that it would happen either on the inauguration or before the inauguration. And we knew that because Trump has literally stoked the flames behind racist his entire campaign, his entire presidency. From the minute he said that he wanted to build a wall to close out undocumented individuals, he drew the line, and that is what stoked the fire. And he just continued with the racist bigotry. He continued and he kept drilling it in to those like-minded people, people who saw the Jim Crow era as when America was great. You know, individuals like that, individuals that don't like equity, that don't like equality, that only care about themselves. You should see some of the things that I've run into out there in the streets during protests. Some of the conversations that I've had with individuals that don't look like me. They would say things as if they were trying to appease to me, but then they would backpedal and say that everyone should just worry about themselves. That is not how we achieve equity.
I'm speaking with Michael Oratade, the president of Black Lives Matter 860 in Hartford. Mr. Oratade, where does the Black Lives Matter movement go from here, would you say?
Well, we don't stop. Every time that a piece of legislation is introduced that is in support of equity, we support it, we get behind it, we get out there, we try to tell people about it. We just continue to activate. We continue to support individuals that are suffering from systemic racism. Black Lives Matter 860 was just in Naugatuck due to an issue where a teenager was sending racist messages on Snapchat about her father being the chief of police, and he's out, he's going to shoot Black people. You know, he's going to shoot expletives in the street. And that's what he's going to do now that he's the chief of police. And it's our job to get out there to say that that type of rhetoric and that those type of messages are wrong and that she needs to be held accountable. And it's we're going to have to keep fighting until people understand that this is wrong, that she's learning that from someone, that we can no longer continue to play stupid and act as if this is going to go away. So Black Lives Matter is doing a lot of work. You know, we're working with Chris Murphy and our statewide steering committee that we just started not too long ago. One of the main fights is to declare racism a public health crisis in the entire state of Connecticut so that we can get some federal funding that will go towards the institutions that need it. That is including our education system, our prison system, and our healthcare system, investigation and legislation. So Black Lives Matter 860 is doing our part in order to support legislation that is passing now or that is being brought to the table now, but we're also collaborating with other organizations to make it more possible, getting out there and educating our community. So we have a lot on the table.
And you're talking about legislation, Connecticut state legislation.
Yes.
I noticed you have a Facebook page. Speaking about state legislation, you have a Facebook page with the title Michael Oratade for Connecticut Senate District 1. You're gearing up for a run in 2022?
Yes. I do plan on running for Senate in Hartford. Mm-hmm. It's where I was born and raised. I believe that we can introduce a lot of positive legislation. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Okay. Through everything that I've been studying, I know that there needs to be a plethora of changes. And to me, I see it, I'm a very goal-oriented person. So when I see legislation like what Biden is proposing to completely abolish, he didn't use abolish. He said, we're going to get rid of private prisons, essentially. I see that as an opening to reflect on how our prisons are operating. These are the type of things that I would like to affect through policy. And it's all a work in progress. If we get racism declared a public health crisis, and excuse me one more second, we get access to federal funding, you get access to people who can do research to look at all the different areas that have been plaguing Black and brown people. One of those places is the prison system. If I can introduce legislation so that our prison systems are more rehabilitative, I have a lot of connections through Black Lives Matter, A6O, for individuals who actually go into the prisons and do trainings so that when people get out, they get a union job. These are the type of things that we need to be supporting. But unfortunately, you know, individuals that do hold the Senate seat, I believe that their hands are tied. They don't know what to do next. They don't understand the impact of, you know, racism on Black lives, brown lives, poor white people, working class Americans. They don't understand how they can help them. And I'm unsure as to why, but I do believe that the person that I am, you know, preparing myself to run against, during someone was lobbying in the LOB and they had a Black Lives Matter item on, and he said, well, how would you feel if I wrote white men lives matter or something along those lines? And for a man that grew up in Hartford, to me, that tells me that you cannot represent my community. So it's the reason why I chose to prime myself in District 1, because we need someone who is going to represent my community. We can't have anyone with skewed perspectives on this particular issue representing my community. It just isn't going to work. The type of legislation that needs to be introduced to help my community is not going to come from an individual who has that perspective. Whether or not he realizes that it is wrong now, he is going to be on a lifelong journey towards anti-racism. He is not anti-racist. He cannot hold a position where he has power to pass legislation over a community that is mostly Black and brown. So it is why I'm priming myself. And this is just one area, the prison system. I have a bunch of legislation that will completely change the entire energy grid in Connecticut. A bunch of ideas that I want to bring to the table. I support the Crown Act. I support fully funding pilot, which is payment in lieu of taxes. These are things that the community needs to know about, because this is how money gets into the community. This is how we get a lot of issues solved and we get people out of prison and we end recidivism. So these are the things that I'm working on. And I believe that I do have the potential to beat him and remove him from his seat, even though he has a lot of political capital. It's not about your reputation. It's about what you do for the community.
Mr. Orotati, we look forward to talking with you again about some of the ideas you've just mentioned. And thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michael Orotati is the president of Black Lives Matter 860, a Hartford-based Black Lives Matter group. Last summer, in the wake of many protests demanding racial justice, we wanted to look into the history of resistance to racial injustice in the United States. And on that program, Crystal Feimster, an associate professor of African American Studies, History, and American Studies at Yale, shared with us insights that helped to clarify how the country arrived at that point, demonstrations in the streets in 2020. We've asked Professor Feimster back today to consider, 6 months later, to consider the impact those Black Lives Matter demonstrations are having on the history of the country and where we go from here. And, of course, the vast majority of those demonstrations were peaceful. Professor, thank you for joining us again on The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. First of all, have I jumped to conclusions? Is it too early to consider how history will view the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020?
No, I mean, with historians, it's never. Yesterday, we could have started talking about this. You know, as far as historians are concerned, we're always like, you know, now is always the time to talk about the past. So, no, I don't think it's too soon to really think about how the protest of the summer have really changed the way that America is thinking and talking and engaging on questions of racial inequality, and not just for the good, right? I don't think that we can not think about what happened. On the siege on the Capitol is not a part of this history, right? So I don't think it's too soon.
Did the demonstrations, do you think, affect the outcome of the 2020 election, putting a Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in office?
I think that, you know, when I think about what are the outcomes of those protests, I have a long list, and I think the election of Joe Biden, President Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris are a part of that trajectory. I think we can't understand Joe Biden's pick of Kamala Harris as his VP running mate as not being a product of those protests in the summer to bring a Black woman on the ticket who has worked and thought about policing as a kind of career. So I do think, his choice, I think their victory comes out of that moment where you saw Black folk and brown people and young people of all races inspired to act. And to act not just in terms of protest, but in terms of politics, right? To register to vote, to register other people to vote. I think we saw it play out in Georgia in those runoffs. I don't think, flipping Georgia was an accident or a coincidence. I think it is definitely a part of that trajectory that began, we could argue that it began in, the summer. But I think Black Lives Matter would debate us about that because we know that that movement had been in the works for 10 years. And we know that other political groups and grassroots organizers and politicians have been thinking about these issues and pushing for change for decades, right?
And you touched on this a moment ago. Did those demonstrations also become fodder for the far right and white supremacist groups in the country to spark hatred, more division, and as you mentioned, leading to the attack on the Capitol on January 6th?
I think what happened in the summer and how that's linked to the far right. The far right has been active, right? I think that they have been there, and those people who have been organizing around racial, economic, and political justice, understand that the far right had been planning and scheming. They've been planning and scheming since Reconstruction, right, in terms of if we think about white nationalist groups and white nationalist violence. And then I think it would be, I think we can't always separate white nationalist groups and extreme right from the kind of everyday workings of our society, right? That what we saw on the Capitol, we saw that, our military and our police state has been infiltrated. I don't want to use the word infiltrated, but people who are white supremacists, who are radical white nationalists, are part of those institutions. And I think that has been something that people who have been committed to, the sort of general theme of thinking about Black Lives Matter and equality have made that case, right? That the police brutality that we see is about a long history of white supremacy and policing and how that intersects. So I think for some of us, it wasn't a surprise. I don't think that the protests of the summer and blame those created more divisions. I think those divisions were already there. I think that what Black Lives Matter and the protests did was magnify, made it possible for people to see white nationalists, and then what the white nationalists did was made it possible for America to see their commitment to violence and to anti-democratic politics. So I think that that's what's new. I don't think those divisions were created or intensified. They were made visible in a way that makes it difficult for people to look away or to argue that Black people are hypersensitive or that they're overblowing the issue.
Is then the recent backlash by hate groups, could that be interpreted as a sign that the nation's actually moving forward with all of this sort of boiling to the surface, almost like ripping the Band-Aid off?
I mean, I think, Crystal would like to say, yes, we're moving forward. And it is the backlash is a kind of indicator of the resistance to that change, right? Because I do think that what we saw in the attack on the Capitol was a real response to the election of a candidate who wants to put racial equality and social justice front and center, who put a Black woman on his ticket, that it happened after, Georgia was flipped. So I do think it is a response to some of the forward-moving steps. But the historian, Professor Feimster, would say, if we've learned anything from history, right, that the minute we think we've won, two steps forward, there's always one step back. I think the backlash is a reminder, or that attack on the Capitol is a reminder that, power does not, when people think they're losing power, they don't give up the fight, right? So I think things will probably get worse before they get better. But I think there is momentum. And I think we have seen change in the last 6 months. And I imagine we will see change in the next 4 years, but there will nonetheless be setbacks. And I think that's what we've learned from history, that the struggle is a continuous struggle, right? That we can't get comfortable, that we always have to fight for right. It is not a given.
Would you say that this set of circumstances is unique in American history, the demonstrations, the murders that led up to the demonstrations, the aftermath of the demonstrations, the election of Biden and Harris? Is this set of circumstances, generally speaking, unique in American history?
I mean, of course, I think it's unique in many ways. It's familiar in other ways, right? It's unique in the fact that, we have the first African-American, the first Asian-American, the first woman elected to the vice presidency of the United States. That is unique in itself, right? But I do think there is something familiar to young people, right? Wanting and demanding more, right, than the generation before them. And that's not to say that they're not standing on the shoulders of people who came before them. But that the marches that we saw this summer were emblematic and similar to the marches of the 60s, right? And so I do think there is something unique, but there is something familiar, and that the past actually matters, and that we have to understand where we are, where we fit in this longer history.
Where do you think a movement like Black Lives Matter goes from here?
I mean, when I think about the earliest iteration of the Black Lives movement, and their, you know, 40-point platform that called for, and oftentimes people want to boil down Black Lives Matter to about police brutality. But I think the agenda and the platform that they laid out in its earliest days of its organizing, we probably check one bullet point, and then it's probably a half check, right? It's maybe check minus, as I would say to my students, not check plus, in terms of getting, state and local officials to think about how to police better, how to reform their policing, and how to root out white supremacist practices in policing. That we've seen change, some of the calls that they've made, demands and change in the way that we think about our carceral state, and how we imprison folks, right? But we also know that embedded in that is, in their arguments and in their demands, it's about environmental justice, it's about health justice, it's about housing justice, right? So the work to be done is in many ways relentless and infinite. I think what is particular and unique about this moment is that we have a president who has centered racial justice and racial equality as part of his platform, as a part of his agenda, right? That he's not going to think about and do work around COVID without thinking about the racial implications. And he's going to be thinking about that at every, or at least he's made the claim that he is going to be thinking about racial justice and racial equality as key to all of his legislation and change and the way that he governs. And I think that's I don't know if we've had that before. And that's not to say that Obama was not thinking about race, but because of his particular position as a Black man in America, he couldn't center his politics in that way, in the way that Biden and Kamala Harris have been able to do from the jump, right? I think Obama was always reacting, and that Biden and Kamala are able to operate from a place of to be proactive on these issues, and that's unique. And I don't know what it's gonna lead to. It makes me optimistic. It makes me hopeful. But again, the historian knows and has seen that pattern of whether we want to call it backlash or resurgence. We know that groups go underground and reactivate. So I remain optimistic. But cautious.
Well, using that historical perspective, which may be dangerous to ask a historian, but using that historical perspective, what or who do you think has been able to change how people in this country view race and view racial justice? What's encouraged people to embrace equality successfully?
I don't think that we can overlook the gains of the civil rights movement, right? I don't think that we can ignore how our society was fundamentally changed after the 60s. And I think, as one of my colleagues in African-American studies, the historian Robin Kelly has said, that we couldn't understand the summer without taking stock that we had a whole generation of young people who were educated quite differently from their parents and their grandparents, that they grew up, admiring Martin Luther King, that they grew up imagining a Black president, voting for a woman president, right? So we had a generation that has taken courses in civil rights, have learned about women's liberation. Their whole sort of cultural and cultural world is I want to use their language, is kind of tagged with you know, historical figures. They know who Gloria Steinem is. They know who King is. You know, Biden mobilized Ella Baker, right? They grew up with Rosa Parks. So I think that, and they grew up in a diverse and a more integrated society. And that's not to say that our education system isn't in many ways as segregated as it had been in the past, but they've grown up in a world very different from their parents and the generations before them. So I think that lived experience actually matters. Knowing somebody from a different racial and ethnic background makes you more open and empathetic. And I think that we have a generation that has been exposed in ways that no generation before has been exposed to this idea of racial equality and understand the benefits of that.
Professor, thanks so much for taking time and putting into historical context the events of this past year and the beginning of this year. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for hosting this show. I think it's really important for us to continue to have these conversations. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and we hope to talk with you again. Professor Crystal Feimster, Associate Professor of African American Studies, History, and American Studies at Yale University. Joining us now is Scott X. Esdale. He's president of the Connecticut NAACP and a member of the NAACP's National Board of Directors. Mr. Esdale, welcome to The Full Story.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. To understand the work of the NAACP in today's social and political climate, I think knowing some of its history, which I understand officially stretches back more than 100 years to 1909, is important. That was an incredibly challenging and difficult time to organize an interracial effort to promote racial justice and equality in this country.
Well, it's interesting that Black History Month on February 12th, actually the same birth date of Abraham Lincoln, the NAACP was founded. We're actually going to be 112 years old this year. This will be our 112th anniversary in existence. And the organization came out of the Niagara Movement. You talked about how tough it was during those particular times. Mm. In 1909, we couldn't organize in the South. We had to organize in the North about what was going on in the South. And the Niagara Movement, we had to be all the way up near Canada. And the organization was actually founded in New York City in 1909. As I stated earlier, it's 112 years old, but we started organizing in the early 1900s based on striving to stop the lynchings in the South. And it was the white supremacist organizations like the KKK and the organizations that we saw in Washington, D.C. in early January, those type of organizations where individuals that were involved in law enforcement, individuals that were public officials, they wore hoods at night to hide their identity. And during the day, they walked around as law-abiding citizens and public officials, but at night they were cold-blooded, heartless terrorists, and this is the reality that the NAACP, the organizations that we had to face, the organizations we had to fight against, the public officials that we had to fight against, the law enforcement that we had to fight against, and we've been fighting for it, fighting against these evil forces for over a century.
There have been many movements, large and smaller, since then to fight overt and systemic racism, as you point out. Has the NAACP always been aligned with those efforts or most of those efforts?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we've seen a lot of different organizations come and go over the years. We are the largest and oldest civil rights organization in the world. We have over 500,000 members, 2,200 branches throughout the world. And in Connecticut, we have 16 branches and over 10,000 members. Youth councils and college chapters on eight college campuses across the state. So we've been doing this for a very, very long time, way before I was born. And we hope to keep this organization alive and well long after I'm gone.
Now, of course, we all know that last year, thousands of people took to the streets all over the country, all over the world, really, with the Black Lives Matter movement calling for racial justice. And those protests were racially mixed. Is Black Lives Matter continuing the work and the intention of the NAACP?
Yeah, I would say so. This is nothing new. I mean, we've been working with blacks and whites. Actually, the NAACP was founded with black and whites coming together to create the NAACP. The Civil War in the 1800s, striving to end slavery in America, were black and whites coming together and getting slaughtered. And one of the most brutal and vicious and bloodiest wars America's ever seen was the Civil War. So this is nothing new. This has been going on in America, social media, and with the access to so much television and cable television and digital information. It's a lot more in your face, but this is nothing new in America. It's been going on for a long time. Black and whites have been fighting against these evil forces for centuries, and we're really glad that a new generation is picking up the banner.
Does has the momentum of the Black Lives Matter protests has it influenced the agenda that that you've worked on for this coming year?
I think that the protests, you know, have brought more awareness to it. But the NAACP has been fighting against police brutality, as I stated, since we've been in existence. This is nothing new. It's just that we're seeing a new generation getting energized and getting active and getting involved. We're seeing a huge wave of political activism, but, you know, this is nothing new. We've seen that with President Obama. We've seen it, you know, with John Kennedy. We've seen it many other times. President Kennedy. I just think that we have a new generation that's active and involved, and we're really excited about them embracing the movement, and we're encouraging them to stay in the movement and see this thing through. We have a lot more work to do, as we've seen. There's been a huge backlash to this movement. We've never seen, at least in my lifetime, where people have overthrown the Capitol, people of all these individuals that were talking about Blue Lives Matter, they actually went in there and killed police officers. So where was Blue Lives Matter during that insurgent riot and terroristic behavior that went down in Washington, D.C.? We're seeing that there's a lot of manipulation and a lot of strategic strategies to cover up racist and terroristic behavior. And it's imperative that people call it for what it is. And it's also imperative that people get active and get involved to shut this nonsense down. It's alive and well. It's the same type of racism that we were facing during slavery. And it's still here in America. America has not dealt with this. And they keep shucking and jiving around when it comes to really dealing with racism in America. And as you see, that it's still very pervasive in this nation.
The pandemic has highlighted many of the racial inequalities that persist in this country. How has that played out in Connecticut?
Oh, absolutely. The rate of black people dying by this pandemic and being affected by this pandemic on the economic side, well, at first on the health side, on the economic side, on also the issue of education, virtual learning, the huge digital divide in reference to individuals having access to the internet and access to adequate tech equipment. It's really showcased exactly how the haves and the have-nots are so far apart here in America. And, you know, our country is really, really in bad shape. And it's extremely important that if people want this nation to be a continue to be a power broker and a leader in the world, if they don't get this thing straightened out with this racism and this racist attitude where everything is based on race, everything is based on I'm better than you, I want everything, you should have nothing. We also saw, you know, when Bernie Sanders was running for office and Elizabeth Warren was running for office, the young people were coming out in numbers, huge numbers, advocating for universal health care, advocating for student loans to be abolished. And what we saw was everyone coming out and calling them socialists and calling them communists and calling them all kinds of nasty and dirty names. But as soon as the COVID hit, all the major corporations were reaching out for corporate welfare and striving to get a check, a socialist check, to keep their businesses alive. So, you know, the game changes. Another game stays the same, but the names change. But we have to get away from this narcissistic, racist attitude and calm down, be rational, and look out for everyone, and be a real leader, not only here in America, but all throughout the world.
We do, of course, have a new president and Vice President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and they've made racial justice one of their priorities. Do you feel that this could be a turning point in the struggle for equality and justice?
I think the jury's still out. 94% of the black community voted for Biden and Harris. And it'll be interesting to see the return on the huge political investment that we've put into their administration. As I stated, the jury is still out, but I'm looking for meaningful and measurable results from this administration and not a lot of rhetoric and symbolism. We need substance, and we need it now.
What are the Connecticut NAACP's priority for 2021?
Okay, so COVID-19, dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact that it's had on our communities across the state in reference to police accountability is a huge issue. In reference to law enforcement and community relations, another huge issue is minority teacher recruitment, the lack of diversity in urban schools right now. I think that, you know, 85% of the school districts, urban school districts, faculty are individuals that are from outside of our community, and black and brown people represent about 5 to 7%. And I'm talking about black and Puerto Rican. Black and Puerto Rican individuals represent like 5 to 10% of the teachers in the school system. We need to highlight that issue and turn it around. We're also really focused on job development and bringing jobs back to the communities. Right now, we've been, as I've stated before, we've been impacted tremendously around COVID-19 and losing so many jobs in our communities. We are going to be having the conversation and the hard conversation and dialogue with the state legislature on how they're going to be bringing jobs back to the communities that we represent. So those are the top priorities, even though there's so many other issues around individuals that have been impacted by one of the major issues that I just finished having the conversation is around foster care, DCF, how many homeless children that we have in our communities right now that are couch surfers. We have so many individuals that are coming out of the prison system. I think that in 1986, there were 6,000 people incarcerated across the state. When Dan Malloy was in the office, it went up to like 24,000, not just during his administration, but it over the years, it went up to 24,000. And now I think he started downsizing it up to like 12,000. I think Ned Lamont, Governor Ned Lamont, is striving to get it down to like 8,000. So we're talking about 14,000 to 16,000 individuals coming back into society. And reentering back into society, and there are no jobs for them, nor are there jobs for individuals that are already out here. So we have some serious issues that are going on in Connecticut, and the NAACP has their hands full.
Mr. Estale, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and looking forward to a continued relationship with you guys.
Great.
You guys,
yeah, we'd love to talk with you again.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Scott X. Estale is president of the Connecticut NAACP and a member of the NAACP's National Board of Directors. What's your experience with the fight for racial justice? Tell us about it. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's our show for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Dan Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.